I'm Ryan Conley, writer, director, and host of Film Riot, and you're listening to the Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is the Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals in the video production and filmmaking industries. Today, we celebrate the 10-year anniversary of Film Riot with Ryan Conley. Ryan and I discuss the making of his latest film, There Comes a Knocking, and how this short film could be the first step towards a feature film. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Shutterstock, Hedge, and Premium Beat. Well, Ryan Conley is truly an inspiration to me, and I'm sure many of you guys, all of you guys, out there in the Go Creative Show world. I mean, he's created an empire with Film Riot. He really has. I mean, he has redefined the way that production is done because he shares everything with his audience. And it really is remarkable how much knowledge he shares with people. I mean, it's great. I love going to his site. His YouTube page is amazing. His podcast is great. His work is fantastic. I just love the guy. And I'm so glad he's back on the show to talk about his latest film, There Comes a Knocking. There's a big story there on how it was created and how it's being used to sort of move his career a little bit further. And of course, we're also celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Film Riot. It is amazing what these guys have done in 10 years. So that's all coming up in just a couple of minutes. But before we get there, I want to draw your attention to our social media pages, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Why? Because when we have upcoming guests, like we did on this episode, we invite our audience to ask questions. So you're going to hear a few audience questions in this episode as well. And we're doing it all the time now. It's working out great. So please follow us on all of those social channels so you can get your questions heard on the show. Let's take a quick break and talk about Shutterstock. Now, Shutterstock, you know and love them for their images and their footage. They've got music on there as well. We always talk about how they have over 16 million royalty-free video clips, and many of them are in 4K. We've been talking about their Shutterstock Elements, which are cinema-grade visual effects for filmmakers. But something you may overlook is their blog, you know? And I think you should change that because their blog is great. One thing I've seen, we've been working with Shutterstock for a while, and what I've noticed is that they're really becoming like a source of inspiration for filmmakers. They really want that to be what people think of them as. And I certainly think of them as that. I mean, I've been talking about going to Shutterstock as inspiration for you know, a couple of years now. You know? I go there all the time. I go to their blog a lot. And I think you should too. So they've got really interesting stories there. Like right there on their homepage now, it's called Subtle But Powerful, Using Pastel Colors in Your Design. Right? Like, where else can you go to have such a mix of things? There's something about shooting aerial video. There's, you know, of course, a whole thing of Halloween imagery, color palettes, things like that. They have Photoshop basics. You know, they have information here for editors, designers, business tips, news, video production. It's a great resource for us. So I suggest you go and check it out for yourself. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, of course. But there's so much there. And that, you know, if you're sort of bypassing it, you're doing yourself a disservice by not checking out the Shutterstock blog. So there it is, shutterstock.com, click on blog, and enjoy and be inspired. All right, let's jump right in to our interview with Ryan Conley from Film Riot. So I'm here with Ryan Conley, director and creator of Film Riot, which is basically taking over all of production. Film Riot has become our production industry. I absolutely love it. And you guys are celebrating 10 years and we can't wait to jump into this interview with you. So thanks for being on.
Oh, thank you, man.
10 years. 10 yeah. years.
It's crazy. It's crazy. It doesn't feel like 10 years for sure.
I mean, why did you start it in the first place? what made you say, you know what? I need to share my experiences with the masses. Because, well, you know, I say the masses, but it couldn't have been the masses at the beginning. I mean, you must have had humble beginnings.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I went to film school in like 2004, I think it was. It's kind of hard to remember now. And then afterwards, it was, you know, very difficult to try to figure out what to do next. And when I started FilmWrite, originally I started as a show called Making the Film, completely independent. I started as a way to catalog my journey toward what, you know, I've been trying to do this entire time, which is get to feature film directing and writing. And at the time, a friend of mine, you know, didn't have the money or resources to go to film school, and there wasn't really anything out there. I mean, there was Indie Mogul, but I mean, Indie Mogul's like all things now, the stuff they've been putting out is incredible. But yeah, at the time, they were really more about like DIY prop builds and stuff like that, less about the actual process of filmmaking. And I wanted to put something out there that wouldn't be, you know, me trying to be a film instructor, because I was very self-aware that I was extremely green. I was pretty fresh out of film school. It had been, you know, several years after film school, and I'd done some short films and things like that. But I understood how much I had to learn. And so we started the show as a way to be like, hey, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I came up with. I have a little bit of knowledge because of film school and a little bit of experience that I have. And, you know, just putting it out there and wanting to build a community around that. That's why in the early days of Film Riot, the opening was me saying, you want to be a filmmaker? Well, so do I. Let's figure it out.
Yeah, not, I love that.
Let me show you how to be a filmmaker. You know, it's never been, and to this day, it's not that. I'm very careful to say, here's how I see it. Here's how I do it. Because, you know, there's so many different ways to do it. And there's so many different ideas that are constantly evolving. And I'm constantly, you know, learning, and I just do it publicly, which is fine. And I got used to. But making the film, you know, Rev 3 back in the day, you know, this is when multi-channel networks was really how you kind of did it. You know, it was like the NBC of the internet. And they caught wind of Making the Film and then connected with me and helped me develop it into Film Riot. And then we launched Film Riot to a decent audience, thanks to Rev 3. And then it just took off from there. And then it's always been about, you know, having fun, trying things, being creative in that space. And I think it took off and it really took a foothold because at the time there really wasn't anything else like that. Now you have tons of incredible stuff. The information is all over the place.
Yeah.
But back then it was kind of frustrating trying to find any good info. You could get some camera reviews, and Andrew was definitely doing all those, his incredible After Effects tutorials, but just the whole process of filmmaking or tracking that just wasn't really out there. And then on top of that, you know, I want to make films, but I was living in South Florida. I had no network. I didn't know anyone. And I thought, you know, if worse come to worse, I could build an audience through this that I release films to, my stories to, even if they're just short films, I would be happy. Although, of course, my ultimate goal is features. If that's all I can do, you know, at least I'm scratching the itch in this way. So maybe, you know, I could build a community where we're helping each other in that way. I'm putting out the information I do have, and, you know, they're giving me their attention.
Do you feel like you have achieved what you set out to do? I mean, it's been 10 years and you must have had, you know, very specific goals in mind. You know, now 10 years later, looking back, do you feel like you've gone where you wanted to?
Yeah, it's definitely in that direction. It's taking longer than I thought it would, which is chalked up to, you know, more inexperience and just tracking that progression over time, which I think is great because, you know, like the new filmmaker, young filmmaker can go back to the early days and watch this progression of trying to get to the place that I've been trying to get to for the past 10 years. And they can see, you know, it's not an overnight success. You know, a lot of the times, like David Sandberg made Lights Out, and to a lot of people, if they don't go look at his story, just think like, oh, it's this overnight, he made this short film, boom, he's making a director. Wow, he's so lucky.
Yeah.
But they don't see the years and years and years and years he put in getting no attention, beating his head against the wall, trying to figure this thing out. And that's the story across the board of every friend that I had that has succeeded. You just don't see that part. So I really love that aspect of it, that it ended up being this very public, you know, attempt at getting to a certain place. And I mean, the show doesn't even show the previous 5 years of me after film school trying to figure things out before I even started Film Riot. So, I mean, it's definitely in the direction of what I want to do and what I want it to become, but we're not there. We're always evolving and trying to figure out, especially as, you know, the landscape evolves around us, you know, trying to figure that out and navigate that, especially juggling, you know, the show with trying to get, you know, feature films made.
We are definitely going to talk a lot about There Comes a Knocking, your new short. But you know, our audience loves you and loves Film Riot. And we've got a lot of questions about just the past 10 years and your experience. So
awesome.
I've got some Twitter questions I want to throw your way. Zachary Farah is asking what your most favorite moment of Film Riot behind the scenes. So he wants to know, what is your favorite moment of Film Riot behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think my favorite moment of, you know, something that happened during, you know, the course of the show and something that we showed of trying to make a thing was when the biggest short film we ever tried to make failed miserably and publicly. it really is because it was going to be, it was a short film called Outsiders. It was going to be like this $300,000-$350,000 short film. There was a 100 person, you know, SFX zombie day at one point, explosions, huge cast and crew. We had someone who worked on Transformers building sets for us, and it was madness. And it was the most stressed I've been my entire life trying to put that thing together. I definitely bit off more than I could chew, and I think we would have got it done, and I think it would have been a really good short film. It would have been our biggest short film to date, even. But in the last minute, a lot of the financing just fell through, unfortunately. And, you know, we were very honest and open and public about that. What happened without, you know, putting any names to it, just what happened. And, you know, I thought it was a great lesson for not only me, but our audience that this is indie filmmaking. You know, it's turbulent. It's, you know, the rocky seas. Sometimes things are up and sometimes they are very down, but we also practiced what we preached. So I'm really proud of that moment because we could have just cried about it, but instead we went out and made one of my favorite short films for $300 instead of $300,000. And that was a short film called Proximity, which we wrote and shot within 10 days because we had, you know, a few resources. Like we had a camera a friend loaned me, and two friends flew in for Outsiders, and now it's not happening. So we were just like, you know what? Let's just do something anyway. And we ended up coming up with, you know, one of my favorite short films that also spawned two other short films. You know, Proximity spawned Sentinel and Ballistic. They kind of all live within the same universe. So it was such a huge learning experience for me across the board of how to put something together of that level. Pitfalls to look out for, but also, you know, when, like I said on the show, when you find a wall, grab a bigger sledgehammer, you know, and those, you know, so there was a lot of learning to it for me. And I definitely have a lot of pride for that moment of, you know, how it ended up turning out and the community that rallied around it as well.
I love that your favorite moment is a colossal bomb. I think that is fantastic. When you're out there pitching new ideas, trying to get funding, all that, do you find that a lot of people are interested in the previous budgets you've had and what you've been able to do with them? Like, is that a big deal for people?
Not at all. Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what we're talking about. If we're talking about short films, no one cares. That really has nothing to do with it. And it depends on what level of financing you're talking about. If it's anything below, you know, $100,000, no one cares. It's just about the talent behind the thing. Once you get into features, yes, that is a factor. What you have done, what you've been able to wrangle and handle up to this point, especially me being a first-time director, you know, there's something that I'm pitching that's, you know, well into the $50 million range, and that's, you know, a lot more difficult to get any traction behind because I am a first-time feature director, even though I have 16 short films, you know, to my name, and Ballistic, you know, probably would have been a $2 million feature the way that we did it if it was a feature. But, you know, not having that experience, you know, they get a little tight-belted, understandably so. You know, the director is yielding a lot of power within that thing and could really sink the ship. So it's understandable. So that does come into play. It's definitely a factor when you go the feature route, the more high-end budgeted feature route. But for shorts, as long as it's, you know, sub six figures, no one's ever brought that up.
I know I'm going to sound like everyone's aunt by saying this, but it's like, why don't you become a filmmaker? It's sort of what it sounds like. But I feel like A24 is like the perfect studio for you. Like they love social media, movies that can create social media campaigns. They love small budgets. They love kind of horror and sort of weird things. I feel like they would appreciate a first-time director. I don't know. It just feels like that's a natural fit for you.
I totally agree. And actually, the episode that's going up either today or tomorrow actually talks about how much I love A24. Funny
enough,
we shot it yesterday. They're so great. And they're the one production company right now that, I mean, there's a bunch of production companies that I love, obviously, but they're the one production company that if I see their logo, I'm like, well, I'm going to watch that movie. They've just been killing it and just putting out amazing film after, and really caring about, you know, that realm of film that's been sort of neglected to some extent. So the stuff that they've been putting out is just, oh, I just love them so much.
Did you see Lighthouse yet?
You know, if I were able to. No, but I want to so bad.
I've got the Robert Eggers and Jaron Blaschke, the director and the cinematographer, coming on the show this, I think tomorrow I'm interviewing them.
What?
Yeah, I love this movie. Like they gave me access to a press screener, so I got to see it a little while ago. It is fantastic. Like you gotta see.
I'm itching to see. I adored The Witch. I just think he's so talented. So great. He's got such an interesting voice and perspective into story. Just from the trailers alone, I'm so excited about Lighthouse. So definitely seeing that as soon as I just need to get a babysitter and go do it.
Damn those kids. They always get in the way.
I know. That's what I tell them. I don't tell them that. I don't.
They wouldn't care even if you did.
Well, they're 4 and 2, so I don't think they'd really know what I was talking about anyway.
Exactly. We get another Twitter question kind of in the same realm. And this may be the same answer, but Mason Hickok from on Twitter wants to know your most humbling moment that you experience, either on set, during prep, or seeing a scene come to life.
I feel like I'm constantly getting humbled in all kinds of ways. Just, you know, an amazing crew that's, you know, coming together, willing to assist in this thing. Like, you come up with this idea, you write the idea, you put all this prep into this idea and this thing that you conjured out of nowhere. Now there's this whole group of people believing in it and getting behind you and trying to help you achieve that vision. And there's something insanely humbling about that every single time without fail. But, you know, then there's those fall on your ass moments that definitely humble you, or, you know, nobody cares that I'm here or doing anything moments that definitely humble you. And I appreciate all of those. You know, they kind of keep you in check. They keep you being a human, you know, and understanding those things. There's even things that I purposely put myself into situations. There was a friend that was doing a pretty large project. It was a several million dollar project, and he wanted me to come on in sort of a behind the scenes way. I mean, I was coming on in to help, and I'm trying to stay vague because I can't really be specific, but
sure.
I was coming on in a larger role, but because of unions, it was kind of, you know, behind closed doors the way that I was doing it. So no one on set really knew who I was or why I was there or what role I was really taking. And I kind of loved that because I even told my brother before I left, I was like, I hope I get yelled at. You know, I kind of wanted to be seen and treated like a PA because I'd never had that experience.
Yeah.
And I want to know what that experience is because I want to be a director and I want to be able to understand every level of that. Because of Film Riot, whenever I've gone onto a larger set, it's, you know, Ryan from Film Riot, friend of the producer or friend of the director.
Sure.
And, you know, you're treated a certain way because of that. So, you know, on this set, I purposefully just made time to do it because I knew it was going to be like that. No one, you know, they were going to see me as a BTS guy or a PA. And sure enough, I did get treated in those certain ways that I assumed I was going to get treated like. And at one point I was yelled at. And so it was really great to have that experience to see. And the person that was doing the yelling was entirely out of line. And it was great to be in that experience and have that pointed at you to create that empathy for everyone that's on set. And I've always tried to keep that in mind, but I wanted to experience it myself to really solidify that in myself. So when I'm on set, and I'm directing, I can, you know, do my best to foster an environment where every single role is just as important and every single person is just as respected, you know, as the producers and director, whether they're emptying trash cans or calling action. No one should be treated any lesser. So stuff like that has been really important to me as well.
That experience must have, you know, made you feel even better about the sets that you create. I mean, just looking at your behind the scenes, my assumption is that your sets are fun. Like, people like to be there. The vibe is good. Everyone's in good spirits. You know, having, and you probably had that leading up to this moment where you got screamed at, but did that moment change the way that you approach your own productions?
It definitely solidified how I do it. You know, I've had a no asshole policy for a very long time and all my friends have that same policy. And, you know, specifically with like Ballistic, you know, I didn't really produce Ballistic. I didn't have time for it. So I brought my friends in from Denton Film that are local here and Maker Table, and they have that exact same policy. And they're such wonderful people who do treat everyone with just as much as respect. And it's why I like working with those people. So the people that they bring on, you know, have that, you know, attitude and outlook at filmmaking, that this is a family from top to bottom, not just above the line. And, you know, over time too, you refine it because you find the people that is like, well, maybe don't work with that person next time. And so far I've been really lucky. I haven't had anyone on my sets. Well, at least to my knowledge, I'm usually the director on my sets. So, you know, some of that stuff is maybe hidden from you, but to my knowledge, and I always go around asking everyone, like, what did you like? What didn't you like? Who would you want to work with again? Who wouldn't you? And, you know, taking, inventory of all that to continue to refine it. So that's always been very much a process for me. And, you know, the set that I'm talking about in question was a special situation. Even to several people that I talked to, they were like, yeah, I've never been on a set like this. So it was a little bit of a situation.
I had a weird thing like that happen really early in my career. We had done, I was directing a commercial that I probably shouldn't have because I was very inexperienced at the time. It was a big budget and there was a celebrity on set. But what I did was I kind of figured, okay, well, you know, I'm going to hire the biggest time producer I can, a really high end DP, and just sort of surround myself with people that have been in the industry for a while and hope that that kind of makes me seem more credible. And, it worked in some ways, but one of the weird things that happened is like the producer that we had, I hear him yelling in, you know, the other side of the set. It was a studio set. So on the other side of the room, I'm hearing him screaming at someone. I'm like, the hell's going on? And comes to find out that he's yelling at a PA and pretty much fires the PA because when the PA went out to do a coffee run, they had like, he brought back the incorrect coffee for me. Like whatever I had asked for, I don't even remember what it was. Like it was wrong. And he's getting screamed at. And the way I found out is I went to the PA and I'm like, why are you getting yelled at? What happened? And he's like, well, you know, I made a mistake on your coffee. And it's like, he was really mad that, you know, I messed up the director's coffee. I'm like, that was crazy. It was the weirdest, like most ridiculous feeling in the world, especially since he was kind of, you know, he was acting in that moment as my mouthpiece. And I really did not like that. And from that point on, it completely changed the way, not, and our sets weren't like that before, but the fact that even happened, I'm like, okay, that feeling I never, ever want again. And it definitely informs the way that you produce things moving forward. It really does.
It really, really does. And, you know, I'm 37 now, still haven't made a feature. And there's a lot of aspects to that I am grateful for because I've had a lot of time to mature and grow and, you know, grow empathy towards others and all this. And, you know, it's those situations where it's like nothing is worth treating someone like that. You don't know what that person's going through in their normal life. You don't know what they're going home to, what you're adding to. And I mean, on top of on the fact that that's just entirely unacceptable in every way. I'm so with you like that. That curbing that and making sure that happens, especially like you said, when it's somebody who's like pretty much a mouthpiece for me, that all that's just really important. I mean, people are way more important than the film.
Absolutely. Durham Crib on Twitter is asking, oh, I like this. Looking back, what do you wish you had learned earlier and what advice would you tell your past self? Ah, I feel we're in therapy now. I love this.
Well, hold on, let me lay down.
I know exactly.
It feels kind of like a cop-out answer, but I don't think I would change anything because everything that has happened has led me to here. And you know, I mean, I think the things that I would go back and change, I think maybe there's two things. One, I would have, which I think I've talked about on the show before, I would have had a little more confidence a little sooner to ask for help instead of trying to do everything myself, be the cinematographer and all that. Ask, you know, a cinema, because I think I was ready to work with a cinematographer sooner than I thought I was. And I think that held me back a little bit, probably, you know, a solid year and a half, you know, held me back. But I think mostly it would be about personal life, you know, spending more time with my wife, not working 18 to 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think that's what, you know, I learned that after I had kids. That really came into perspective of when I'm 80, I'm not going to regret all the films I didn't make. I'm going to regret the time I missed with my family. And that really didn't click until after I had kids. So if anything, that's what I would go back to is, you know, I've always been a massive obsessed workaholic when it comes to film. You know, I eat, sleep, breathe the thing for sure. And there was legitimately a time frame, you know, for 2 years where it was an average of 17 to 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, with, you know, towards 17 being more of the average, but 20 hours a week would happen on a weekly basis. So I would definitely, you know, jump in that time machine and go back and slap myself and tell me not to do that. But that would be the biggest one, not really anything having to do with actual filmmaking.
Let's take a quick break and talk about Hedge. Hedge is a backup software for filmmakers. It's super fast, super, super easy. I love it. I mean, we use it all the time on set because think about it. You're on set. You've got media cards from your camera operators, maybe a behind-the-scenes photographer, your audio techs. Everyone is giving you media cards. And it's your job to make sure it's backed up correctly. Hedge. That's it. Stop dragging files around the Finder. It's insane. It's insane. Hedge is going to make sure that everything's transferred correctly. It's going to give you peace of mind, right? You can import multiple sources and send it to multiple destinations at the same time, all in one interface. Like, so I've got all of my media cards right there in the destination column, in the sources column. And then in my destination column, I have my two hard drives. Always make sure you got a double backup before you leave set. I press transfer and it just goes. It's super fast, reliable. I get an update on my phone when the transfer is done because I have the Hedge Connect app. Now, it's just, it's a no-brainer, right? If you're listening to Go Creative Show, you are a professional. You do this for real. Start using professional software. Now, here's the thing. You get a 20% off discount on the full license by going to hedge.video/GoCreativeShow or typing in Go Creative Show in the coupon code at checkout. But they have a whole bunch of different license options as well. So try it, use it. You guys are going to absolutely love it. It's fast, it's easy, and it's about time you treat your media with the respect it deserves. hedge.video/GoCreativeShow. And lastly, let's talk about Rule Boston Camera. Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment. But it's not about that, you know? Yes, they have a huge inventory. Yes, they have everything you need. Any Hollywood film that comes through or big-time commercial that comes through Boston, they're using Rule because they have everything they need. But you know why else they're using them? The same reason I do, which is the same reason all of us should be, which is they are a production partner. They are. You're going to get expert advice and counsel in pre-production. You're going to get technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they are committed to support you no matter what. The whole time you're on location, the whole time you have their products, they are committed to supporting you. And that's what it's all about. We need support as producers and directors and filmmakers. You want a production partner, and that's what you're going to get at Rule. So check them out for yourself at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. Let's talk about There Comes a Knocking. The film is great. I saw it this morning. I love it. When is it being released?
Thank you.
To the world?
The 28th.
28th of October. So probably about the time that this episode is out. So you guys definitely check it out on filmriot.com. I'm assuming it's going to be right there.
Yep. Yep. It'll be on filmriot.com or youtube.com/filmriot.
So we can I mean, it's a short film. It's under 10 minutes. You know, we can certainly talk about it. You've been talking about it, you know, on your channel anyway, leading up to now and the release.
We could spoil it too. Just if anyone's listening, go stop, people, go watch it, then come back.
Exactly. Go watch it. It's 9 minutes. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
So there comes a really, really great film. I absolutely love
Thank you.
You know, I think your work is always really good and very and varied. Like, you're able to do a whole bunch of different styles. And I think There Comes a Knocking is a really good addition to your, you know, your portfolio of work. Tell me about what inspired this film and what the goal of it is, because I was, you know, I watched one of your videos, your sort of behind the scenes and prep videos for There Comes a Knocking. And I know that this has the very much the intention of turning into a feature.
Yes. So it the origin of this goes back to Ballistic. Even after Ballistic was like the end of my 5-year plan of trying to get to the point where I'm legitimately developing features, not just developing them on my own, just hoping to find a pathway to pitching them, but legitimately developing features. So even when I was editing the film, I was telling my editor, Lucas Harger, you know, if this doesn't work, if this doesn't get the attention I hope it does, I got to start a whole new 5-year plan. But thankfully, after about 3 months of it being online, you know, I started getting contacted from producers and a lot of people wanting to develop this to a feature, and producers with legitimate production companies that had first look deals with places like Warner Brothers and Universal and stuff like that. So it was, you know, it was higher end stuff, and it was the most attention that I've ever gotten. And there were about 4 or 5 producers all wanting to develop the same thing with me. And I didn't really know what to do about that. Like, this was all new. So I'm like, am I supposed to develop it with all of them? Do I tell each other about it? So then I asked, a friend of mine who is a director in the system right now. And he was like, yeah, now's the time, you need a manager. So then it was like, well, how the hell do you get a manager? So then I had to figure that out. And I finally ended up getting managers. And then I ended up sort of developing Ballistic with them at 3Arts, because 3Arts also develops, films. And
let me stop you just for a second. Manager versus agent. So you got a manager or you got an agent? And can you explain the distinction?
I got a manager. I have never had an agent, so I wouldn't be fully comfortable saying what the exact distinction is. But
sure,
you know, agents close deals and such like that. Managers so far are, you know, they're helping me develop this. They connected me with writers. They'll set up, you know, studio meetings. And there's a lot of, from my understanding, there's a lot of overlap on what the two do in some ways. But I have not had a manager to this point, so it's not really something I could fully speak into. I can only talk about my experience with my manager, who I adore.
Sure.
So I don't have a great answer for that one, unfortunately. we developed, you know, Ballistic. They connected me with some writers, and that was a great experience and taught me a lot. And we developed that, and that's actually the one that would be like, you know, a $50 million thing. And me as a first-time director, you know, it's not a great chance that that's going to be my first film, an original piece that's, you know, of such a budget.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit slow goings there. And, I've had this idea for There Comes a Knocking, the feature version, for, you know, like 6 years, 7 years, just the theme of it and what I wanted to do with it and the general concept for it. And recently, I had, about in the past like year at this point, I had finally figured the way into the story, and I developed, I made a whole script. It was like a 52-page scriptment, which is somewhere in between a script and an outline. You know, it'll go through moments of this scene happens, and this is the purpose of the scene, and this generally what happens in the scene, into a fully scripted out moment, you know, that sort of thing. So it really gave the sense of what this film would be. So I sent that along to them, along with a lookbook and a playlist, and just like, hey, here's the vision of the thing I'm trying to do. And they really responded to it. And since then, we started developing the feature together. I went off and wrote drafts and would send it to them, and they would, you know, pick it apart and ask questions. I would go write another draft, and found out there's some places that might be interested. And so, you know, we decided, you know, from their advice, it would be really smart to, you know, make a short film that could serve as a proof of concept for this feature. So when we do take it out to studios, we have that to go along with me because I have a lot of action and comedy pieces, but the only horror piece I have is from, you know, 2012, which I shot even before that and is not a good, you know, indicator of me as a filmmaker now. I'm a totally different filmmaker now and the quality, you know, was of that time. So, you know, having something that would not only show the vision for this film, very specifically, instead of being just a rip reel where I'm taking, you know, clips from other movies and making a trailer out of them, it's my original work showing what I can do, but also just shows the quality that I can pull off, shows that I can pull off horror and the tone that this will be as well. So, you know, both things, showing what the film will be and showing that I can definitely be the one to do it. So that was the intention behind making it. And I've tried to be very open and public about that process. I don't know that that's been done before. That you usually, when you create a pitch film like this, it stays very quiet behind the scenes and you then take that to studios. You don't go public with it. But my whole career has been very public and open and, you know, trying to share that process with people, a process which each one is something where it's like, I don't know how to do this, you know, and I'm figuring it out as I go. And this pitching process, development process is definitely one of those. I've never done this before and I'm learning as I go. So, you know, why not learn publicly so people can learn along with me? So I wanted to do it that way. And my managers really got behind that idea too, you know, because if the short film does really well online, that's just going to help us when we take it places to be able to go, you know, look, this does have interest behind it. So that was really kind of the inception of the whole thing.
So you've got the feature film idea. You have it written. And you're now having to boil this down into 9 minutes. How are you able to create, you know, a 9-minute version or a 9-minute, you know, proof of concept for something so much longer? Like, was that process of paring it down really challenging?
Well, I just wrote something different, something that was in pair. I kind of looked at it like, what if this situation happened to someone else before the story of the film?
Okay.
And I wrote that moment. So it was about, it was a very fun exercise in taking the themes and the tone and generally what I, you know, wanted to do with the nuances and, you know, under the hood type stuff and put it into something in a very ambiguous way. That, you know, is not, I mean, you've seen it. It is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about
very much a teaser.
What is it about? We probably shouldn't have mentioned that earlier. If I was you know, you'd think after 190 episodes of this thing, I would know the proper way of unveiling a story on air, but there is still learning to do apparently. So just tell us, what is There Comes a Knocking about?
I don't usually like really going too far into what it's about for me with my stories, because I do try to keep them in such a way that it's a canvas that's half painted that you can bring your own paint to. All of my films are kind of like that. But you know, it revolves around this vintage door that this woman mounts into her house, and you know, as the title says, that night something comes knocking. And it was something that I really enjoyed with the short film was playing with how to tell you the story without ever telling you the story, like how to tell you what's going on, which of course, hopefully everybody listening to this has seen the film, but of course her husband has passed away. And, you know, for me, he was on his way. He just bought the door. He was on his way home and left her a voicemail. And then after the voicemail, on his way home, got into a car accident, and ended up, dying. And now it's not long after that point, and she's very much in this grieving process, when all this stuff comes in and takes hold. And that's kind of, grief is very much the theme that I'm toying around with here in the short film, and very much what the feature is about. It's something, I mean, I won't go specifically into what about grief, because I think that gives some stuff away about the feature, but also I don't like to, you know, give my opinion so much as ask questions often. And so it's sort of posing some stuff that I've seen revolved around grief, things that I've been through, which is what was most interesting to kind of develop and explore and ask questions to myself about while writing the feature. And then even more fun to try to, you know, put into just 9 minutes without ever really diving fully into it. But, you know, if you latch onto that grief idea and then go watch the short film again, maybe you might start being like, oh, okay, this and this, why this, and maybe this is what's happening. And I think that stuff is really interesting. But the thing that interested me very much about the short film is just that 9 minutes of trying to plant enough seeds to where you could put the rest of the story together that I never showed you, the before and even the after, based off of just this, you know, moment in time that the short film does give you.
What I think is interesting about this film as compared to your others is that your others feel like complete stories, which is cool, and they feel like an end. This one, when it's over, you're like, oh my God, you really feel like you could absolutely watch an entire film about this moment. Like you want it fantastic. So badly to just be a scene that you now can launch into the rest of the feature for. Like it's really good at teasing. And that's why it almost felt to me like it was a scene from the film. It's interesting to hear that you kind of wrote something separate as a way to get people excited. Yeah. But I loved it. I mean, I want more. I want this thing to happen.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and that was kind of the tricky thing and kind of the nerve-wracking thing around this too, because it does have to be, you know, kind of a teaser, but I do want it to be living on its own as its own piece of entertainment and not be a frustrating end, but something that's like, you know, oh, I really hope this gets made because I want to see more. And, you know, the audience's response will tell me how successful I was or not on that. But, you know, it can't be something that finishes because this is, in the end, a proof of concept. So it has to be something that just hooks and makes you want more, especially when we're going to be taking this out to pitch the thing. Because if it's something that, you know, you feel closure at the end and it's like, oh, great story, moving on. You know, I don't think it'll incite as much desire to go out and elaborate on the thing. But if it's something that in the end, it's like, well, where does it go from there? You know, it's kind of like when you're watching a Netflix show and it ends in such a cliffhanger and you're like, oh, and it starts playing the next one. You're like, okay, one more. You know, yes. That's kind of the thought process I had behind it. Whereas, you know, that episode was great, but it ended in such a way that you're like, well, now it's not over and I got to find out where it goes. And, you know, so it was this very strange balancing act of trying to accomplish those two things at once. And, you know, I have no idea if I accomplished it or not, but, you know, hopefully people dig it.
What do you feel like the night before you're just about to release your next short, your next film? What's it feel like? Are you nervous?
Terror. yeah, for sure. Because, you know, for, you know, all of us who make films, it's less of a, I want to make films and more of a, I have to, you know, it's a part of me. It's, you know, I can't help myself. I always say like, if you could help it, why would you do this? It's so stressful and hard and, you know, just depressing at times to where it's like, you know, if I could help it, I would probably do something else, but I can't help it. I have to do this for whatever reason. you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So, you know, it's so much of a part of you. And when you do make a short film, especially one like this, it's a very personal short film, to a project that's really important to me. You know, it's when someone doesn't like it, they're kind of saying they don't like you in a way to you, you know, it's kind of how it feels like. So there is a lot of stress involved. I always say putting out a short film is like telling someone you love them and then waiting to see if they say it back or not. You know what I mean?
That's a great way. Yeah. That's a great analogy. It really is a vulnerable moment. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. And that's why it's like, you know, especially when filmmakers respond to other filmmakers' work in a certain way, I'm like, are you not a filmmaker? You know what I mean? Like, it's like, do you not do this? Because you should know better than to, because it's totally fine. And when somebody doesn't like my work, that doesn't really affect me. It's when someone uses words like lazy or, you know, this is just pure trash, stop trying, you know what I mean? That's when it's like, what are you talking about? It's like, okay, calm down. But it's, you know, not liking something doesn't really bother me. It's totally valid. And I do like hearing the negative because that stuff, you know, teaches you. You learn from that, you know. And then sometimes it's like, well, this clearly wasn't for this person. This is not their type of film.
It's hard to separate that, though. I mean, if people are trashing you, I mean, how, you know, it's always the one negative comment that sticks with you, no matter what.
Yes. Yes. There was, I don't remember what film it was, but we put out one of our shorts. It was earlier on, probably like, you know, between 2010, 2011, maybe somewhere around there. And we put something out and somebody said, asked me how it was going. Do people seem to like it? And I'm like, it's not going well, man. It's pretty much all the comments are negative. It's crazy. We've never had a response like this.
Wow.
And then my brother's sitting next to me and he's like, what the hell are you talking about? All the comments are good. There's like four bad comments. Like, nuh-uh. And he brings it up on the phone and we go through it. And sure enough, I created this situation in my mind that didn't exist. Like, all that existed were bad comments because I read like eight bad comments out of 300 and something. so I was like, oh. And that's when I really became aware of that fact of what, you know, what you're saying is it oddly, you know, when there's a negative comment, that's so much louder than the 20, like, I love this so much comments that came before it. I'm a little bit better with that, but, you know, I don't think that, you know, is something that you'll ever really be great with. It's, you know, it's a hard pill to swallow when someone doesn't love this, your baby, basically.
I don't think you'll ever get over it. I mean, people working at super high levels, look at Joker. I mean, there was sensitivity around the negative comments for a giant film that everybody loves and made tons of money. I mean, it was the number one film for how many weeks now? And there is still sensitivity around the initial like hate for it. And if, you know, if you're going to be sensitive at that level, you're going to be sensitive forever. It's just, artists are sensitive. We are sensitive people.
It's so true. We're delicate. We're delicate flowers.
I want to talk about pre-production for There Comes a Knocking. You have a video on your camera, your lens testing and your location scouting. So I kind of want to dive into those.
Sure.
First things first, let's talk about the camera package you chose. Why? And then I want to get into the lens testing.
Yeah, the camera package was heavily, influenced by my DP, of course, Chase Smith. He knows the Alexa, and he very much wanted to shoot on the Alexa. And I agree, it's my favorite camera to shoot on as well. It just has a sort of, for lack of a less used term, milky quality to it that feels very cinematic to me. I mean, obviously the Red and all the other cameras are great too. I mean, I shot ballistic on a C200. So it doesn't really, in the end, it doesn't really, you know, whatever camera you give me, I'm going to shoot the thing on. But sure, if I had my choice, it'll probably usually be the Alexas. I just love those cameras. I love how they feel. Although all the rest are definitely viable options and beautiful cameras as well. And, but I mean, really it just came down to, you know, Chase, what do you want to shoot on? You know, he wanted to shoot on the Alexa and I'm like, me too. Okay, let's go.
Yeah. Was it an Alexa Mini?
Yes. Yeah, it was.
And then what were you pairing with it for lenses?
So I went back and forth a little bit on whether to go anamorphic or not. I adore anamorphic. I love the look. It's so cinematic to me, and it very much lends itself to how I kind of see things. It's just I see in that sort of format. But I went back and forth a little bit because the door is a bit taller. So, you know, I was thinking maybe we should go more of a 1.85 direction to add a little bit of that height there. But we did some tests and decided it was going to be just fine. I'm glad that I stuck to that because I think it works really well for the film. And then in the past, I've worked with anamorphics that are give a little bit of a dirtier look because that, you know, is what those films needed. I do tend to write films about, you know, broken people when it's not comedy. So I like for the visuals to kind of, follow that path as well, be a little bit dirtier, be imperfect, you know, warp the edges sometimes, have, you know, those imperfections in there because that's the story I'm telling. And in this one, it definitely had that as well, but I didn't want it to be as prevalent, especially because we were going to be indoors, we were going to be in hallways. Originally, we were going to go with the Master Anamorphics. We did some tests with those, and those are in the episodes. And they're gorgeous, but they were a little too clean. And we were still going to go with them. And I was thinking, you know, I could mess with it and post a little bit. It's, you know, it gives a really gorgeous image. But then we ended up not being able to get those. They weren't going to be available for the time frame we were shooting. And then my DP ended up being, he was prepping for another shoot and he had Cooks and he did some tests with that and sent me that. And I'm like, there it is, that's it. So it kind of just landed on the exact right lens almost accidentally, because once I saw that image that these lenses produced, you know, I responded immediately to, you know, that's the exact look that I'm wanting. So we ended up finding a local rental house, MPS Studios, that were kind enough to give us a deal on those, and it just all worked out.
Now, for your lens testing, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes if you guys haven't seen it, but in your behind-the-scenes video of the lens testing, you hadn't yet tested the Cook anamorphics, and according to that video, you sort of had settled on the Master Prime anamorphics, but
yes,
you kind of took the lenses into your home environment, did some real testing, so it went well beyond just doing testing at the rental house,
yes,
you know, against charts and stuff, and how important is that, do you think, for, you know, filmmakers to invest the money in getting the lens rentals, you know, for a day or so before you decide, bring them to a location, no matter what, even your own home, and just seeing what these look like in the real world?
You know, for me, it's very important. I don't really care about the scientific tests. I'll leave that to people who, you know what that does and do care. I mean,
yeah,
they're
exactly
important, but you know, that's not my field. My field is an emotional one, an emotional response. So what I'm working toward is, how am I going to give the audience the experience I want to give them? How am I going to put them in, you know, the seat I want them to sit in and feel those things? And, you know, numbers aren't going to tell me that, you know, a chart's not going to tell me that. But if we get into a space that has some depth to it, it's a real environment, so I can see how everything's interacting in, you know, different lighting and different natural lighting with different faces, that lends itself a lot more for me to be able to see, what I'm going to be looking at in the end. So that's a lot more helpful to me. Even Chase did the test with the Cook at a rental house, but the ones that, you know, worked for me at all were the ones that were pointed at a human, you know,
sure,
at a face. And that's when I was like, yes, that. And he shot some, we couldn't show it on the show because we didn't want to show, like, you know, the back room of, you know, this rental house, because we didn't have permission to, but he shot some of that stuff. And that's the stuff that really told me, yes, this is the lens. The charts and all that are, like I said, extremely useful, but not so much for me. It's useful to the people who, you know, who know how to use those properly. And above all else, I'm a writer director, so that's, you know, it's not really useful to me. I want stuff that I can react to emotionally.
You are listening to the Premium Beat Song of the Week. This one is timely, isn't it? It's called Halloween Time by One Wave. Premium Beat is where to go to get all of your royalty-free music and sound effects. Their website's great. It really is great. There are thousands and thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each, and many of them give you a whole bunch of options. I'm talking stems, I'm talking cutdowns, loop sets. So you can customize the track that you love. You can customize it perfectly to fit your project. They also have these really great keyboard commands so that you can very easily navigate through the site, which is really awesome. Nobody else is doing stuff like that. And so it's all there. High quality, great website, tons of variety, and a fantastic blog called The Beat. So check it out for yourself over at premiumbeat.com. And there is still so much more interview to go, but before we finish it up, we just want to talk about Magnanimous Rentals. Yes. Magnanimous Rentals is a production equipment rental house based in Chicago, but they ship anywhere in the United States. You can find them at magrents.com, and you'll want to. You will want to, because they got a great inventory, but where they cannot be beat is their prices. Just cannot be beat. They're obsessed with price. Obsessed. Obsessed with low prices, what I should be saying, because it's true. Their regular prices are amazing. Then they have these things called flash discounts. And you know it's a flash discount because it's right there on the homepage in bright red. And it says flash discount with a big lightning bolt icon. But you also know it because the prices are steeply discounted, sometimes 50%. It's madness. And all orders that are over $500 will ship for free. So you got it. Inventory, free shipping for orders over $500, flash discounts. And here's the thing, the flash discounts are only for a limited time. So you need to make sure that you place your order while the flash discount is going on. You don't need to worry about when the order is delivered. You just need to place the order while the flash discount is happening. So I suggest you go to magrents.com every day, because who knows what you're going to find there and who knows what's going to be on flash discount. I got an Alexa Mini on flash discount. So they're putting up some really good quality gear. So check it out for yourself at magrents.com. All right, let's wrap this thing up with the conclusion of our interview with Film Riot's Ryan Conley. Being able to put a good amount of budget into pre-production is a luxury. It definitely is. Yeah. But I've known that, like, especially the further along I get in my own career with like the commercial projects that I do, whenever I do invest in pre-production, I never regret it. And, you know, even though sometimes it's tempting to be like, you know, maybe we can save here and, you know, forget about maybe doing, but maybe we don't need everyone to go to the location scout, maybe just the director and DP, and you make these little decisions. But whenever I invest in pre-production, I never regret it. And I think more and more I'm finding that I'm sort of shifting things a bit and allocating more towards pre-production. Things like, I mean, we haven't really done a lot of lens and camera tests. We usually know what we want to use going into it just because, you know, we've done so many commercials in the past, but like, bringing more people to the location scout, spending more time finding the perfect location, doing a fitting day for wardrobe, things like that, that I wouldn't have normally done, you know, back even 3-4 years ago, I'm now doing more of and liking it a lot. I mean, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. This is the most pre-pro time that I've had. And, you know, doing the lens test, I was lucky enough that Lens Pro, you know, partners with me quite a bit, and they just let me borrow the lenses for a couple days to test them out.
Nice.
So I didn't have to come out of, you know, budget for that. And that's usually why people are going to do them at the camera house and not take them home, because that is going to be a hefty price tag just to test the lenses.
Sure.
But I flew my DP in twice for location scouts and things like that to make sure that he was involved and that we were getting together more and talking about the film and looking at different stuff like that. And I built out lookbooks for pretty much everything. I built out a lookbook for the door. I built out a lookbook for the house, for the wardrobe, for makeup. Just if there was something that I had a specific idea of how it should feel, I just made a whole lookbook for it and just gave that to all my keys so everybody could really see visually, along with a playlist, so everyone could really see visually and kind of log into a tone together of what I'm trying to achieve here, so we could all get on, you know, the same, you know, wavelength and really be making the same thing without having, you know, to second guess themselves. They could just go to the lookbook and be like, oh, okay, yeah, that doesn't work. And very specifically, especially with wardrobe, these colors, not these colors, these shades of this color, not these shades of this color. And so there was a lot of that. I used a CineTracer, Matt Workman's CineTracer, to board almost the entire film. There was only one section of the film that wasn't boarded. And even some moments were, I did a full-on animatic for that. Scene 3, where she's in the living room by the fireplace drinking wine, I did a full animatic of that moment and then brought that into Premiere and added music. Actually, the voicemail that's there, I had already recorded, so I added that in. And that was really important to me because although that seems like a very simplistic scene, the pacing there is fully locked in and there were no options around that. So if the pacing didn't work, that scene was going to crash and burn. And that seems really important for us to put the final, you know, period on, you know, what this situation is. Hopefully all the little clues that we've put in to this point lead to this moment of when you hear those things through the voicemail and, you know, see her reaction, you're like, okay, I get exactly what's going on here. And hopefully, like, to the point of when it happened, you know, not everyone will get that, but the, you know, those clues are in there. And I think that's fun. Some people got exactly what's happening, based off the roses shot, you know, so some people got it right up front, which is really interesting. You know, and some people didn't really understand until the voice, there's a varied response to it so far, which is a lot of fun and really interesting. And that's what I love about filmmaking and doing it in sort of this way is, you know, you get those different experiences with the piece when you do it sort of like that. Just finding that pacing and making sure it would work, because I knew I just wanted to do it in three shots, all very slowly paced, almost no cuts, live in the moment with her. And that stuff can be really scary because there's no safety net of then we'll cut here and then we'll cut here and then we'll cut here, you know? So I did the animatic of that to really make sure we were building out the proper thing.
I love doing animatics. I do them as whenever I possibly can, especially for commercial work, 30s and 60s, that have very specific time constraints. Every time I do an animatic, I'm always looking at them saying, oh, wow, okay. A lot of what I thought was going to happen can't, and we got to change a few things here and there. It really is like a cloud lifted, and it grounds your entire project and really helps you understand what it is you actually need. It helps you from overshooting. It's just great. Like, you have to do it. If for those of you guys listening that haven't done them, I mean, basically an animatic is just like, you're kind of just making a little, you're kind of making your film, but with the material that you have. So like for me, I make it with the location scout photos and, you know, maybe a couple little iPhone clips that we shoot during location scout. Some very, you know, rough graphics, anything just to help you understand the pacing and the time. But it's so valuable.
Yeah, it really, really is. And I'm very much, I mean, it depends on the type of film. Like when it comes to ballistic, I definitely did a lot of prep, but I didn't want to go too far because I knew I didn't want to lock myself into any specific ideas too much because I knew because of what ballistic was. I mean, we made that. There was 8 cameras at some point. There was explosions, guys on wire flying through the air in a location I didn't have a ton of time to really, you know, figure out how I was going to do it in. And we did it for literally like a third to maybe even a fifth of the budget we should have had. Like, so many people were doing it for free and giving crazy favors. So it was really trying to do a whole lot with a whole little. And whenever you do that, you know, I've done enough of it to know nothing's going to plan. Anything that I plan is totally changing. So I don't go crazy with, you know, building out the prep for those sorts of scenes, for action sorts of scenes. But what I will do is I'll create shot lists based off of what I want, revolving all around whys. I want these shots because of these reasons, not because it'll be cool, but because it will specifically do this. So on the day when inevitably I will not be able to do that shot, I can flip on a dime because I know why I wanted to do that shot. So I could do, well, let's do it this way instead because that will accomplish the same goal. Or if I can't figure it out, say to, you know, Chase, my DP and my stunt coordinator, Josh, you know, here's why I wanted to do this shot. What else could we do that will accomplish that same goal? And that's a really good way to kind of, you know, move on the fly and stay very quickly. But with something like There Comes a Knocking, where it was, you know, it was still, it definitely would have been very helpful to have some more money. There was still a lot of, you know, corners that had to be cut to really get it done the way we wanted to get it done. And a lot of favors, of course, as always, and definitely not enough lights. So there was, you know, every light we had at some point, every stand was up, you know, there was no light not being used. And you know, there was a few things, but we knew this ahead of time because we knew what budget we had and we knew what lights we were going to have. So I was able to construct the scenes around knowing that one restriction. And I already knew the location. So within CineTracer, I could build out the location, generally that floor plan pretty close and plot everything out. So with something like that, where it's a little bit more of a slow burn, thriller, horror, I really like making the movie before I make the movie. And I kind of like doing that with everything, but when it comes to action, there really is a limit to how far I'll go because I don't want to get locked into too many ideas that I know are just going to change on the day.
Can you give us some tips on more effective location scouting? Like what should people be paying attention to?
Really good location scouts. That is like a skill in and of itself. And the producers come heavily into play there as well, because there's a lot of logistics to think about when it comes to a location. Like, you know, is there a bathroom? If not, where are we, you know, how are we pulling it? Because now we're going to have to bring in, you know, some kind of porta-john situation. And okay, fine, we can bring that in, but where is it going to go? Is there a place that we can put it? Where is everybody going to park? How many cars are they're going to be? Okay, there's nowhere here. So now we have to figure out a parking situation. Well, there's that church across the street. Will they let us park there? Could maybe we rent the parking space? But But now we have to shuttle people back and forth. So now we need a driver because it's not going to be safe for people to be going back and forth in that way. And safety is always something you need to be thinking about, especially when these, I mean, crossing the street is a very simplistic thing. But once you're working in that sort of environment where everybody's going 1,000 miles an hour, you know, at some point you're very tired at the end of the night, you don't want any room for something to be unsafe. So you definitely want a driver in that situation. And then there's Crafty. Where are you going to put Crafty? How big is your crew? Do you have like a 30, 50 person crew? Well, now you need all those tables and all those chairs. And if it's outside, you might need a tent. What's the weather going to be like? Do you need to make sure all the tables and chairs are tented in? If you're indoors, is there air conditioning? If not, you need to be thinking about that because you don't want people collapsing. You know, so I think the biggest thing about a location scout is beyond, obviously, you need to find the right location for your film, but it's all those logistical things that you need to think about, or they're going to completely derail the film. And you need to think about all those things and have them, you know, in motion and solutions for those before you get on set. So, you know, those things aren't brick walling your day when, you know, most of us are working with a low budget. And even when you're not, I've heard, you know, these stories of how it goes. You know, when you're working with larger budgets, it's the same thing. Everyone's always trying to make their day. So any hiccup like that is really going to offset things in a really bad way. So you want to try to curb those as much as possible. So definitely when it comes to location scouting, I would say the logistics of each location is, you know, one of the most important things you need to be keeping in mind.
In the video where you explained your location scout process for There Comes a Knocking, there's you guys are using a 360 camera walking through the location. Yes. I've never seen that before, but as I'm watching it, I'm like, I have to buy one right now. I have to do this. Tell us about why you used it and what did it afford for you?
Yeah, that one was the Insta360, and I had it for a little while. They wanted me to do a review on it, and I just kept putting it off and putting it off because I was working on other stuff, and I wanted to do something really cool with it. But then the location scouts, the location was coming along, and I was like, oh my God, you know, because there's so many times that we've looked at a location and, you know, I wanted to be like, oh, what was this side of the room like? Mm-hmm. And then no one took a picture of it. And you're like, come on. Cause you didn't, you know, you just didn't think to, but then later you had an idea. And also our gaffer wasn't there and we wanted him to have a really good idea of the space so we could really lock in what lights we needed, what rigging we needed. So, you know, I just had the idea to bring that thing along and just walk through the whole space. So later we could virtually just walk through the whole space again without having to go back out there. You know, it's much better to actually be in the physical space, of course, but this was definitely the next best thing and was really helpful. I'll do it on every location scout that I ever go on, ever again, because we really used it a lot. I built out a 360 video and sent that to a ton of crew members, including my, key grip, my gaffer, my DP. Although my DP was there, I was able to send it to him again. And he just kept going over and over and coming up with ideas of where he was going to put things and how he was going to handle this room. It was just really, really useful. It was also useful to have the location scouts who, you know, they build out these Google Drives of the different locations, you know, each location with its own folder, and you can go through and just look at the pictures and decide on that. And I think the more you do location scouting, the more you can just off the pictures figure out which ones are worthy of, you know, your time to go out there and check out and which ones are just not going to work out for you. Definitely up front, in the earlier days of doing it this way, it was really hard where you're like, well, maybe we'll just go see it, you know? And then yeah. You get there and you're like, yeah, okay, this is not even kind of going to work. But it definitely is a skill that you refine over time, that you're able to look at a picture and say, yes, this is worth us checking out. And actually, the first house that we ended up looking at was the one that we ended up getting.
Yeah, and the house is perfect. I mean, I know you had said you were kind of going back and forth between something a little bit more modern versus this old school Victorian look. I think you made the right choice. It looks fantastic, and it fits that door, which is really our main character.
Yeah, exactly. And the feature is somewhere more in the middle. It does lean toward the tone of the house that we got as far as the color palette and just kind of how it feels. So it's somewhere nice in the middle. And I really liked that too, because it is a little bit of an offshoot from the feature, even visually. So it's kind of separating itself in more ways than one, which I liked a lot. And I just figured, you know, it's 9 minutes. We need to convey a lot in 9 minutes. And that house just had so much character and so much personality. And I felt kind of told its own story just in the way that it looked. But then also logistically, those hallways were so wide and very long. So I knew that I could really get in there and do the stuff I wanted to do with the Steadicam and, more importantly, the dolly, because, you know, you need room for that. And there were some moments, like you saw in the film, where, you know, there's that slow walk toward where we're building tension, and the other places just didn't have the distance I needed to be able to really build that tension and play that moment in the way that I needed to. So I knew that moments would not land without that distance. So just all around, that house really was the one that that was going to be the only one that worked the way that I needed it to.
In our last few minutes, I want to talk about the post-production, color grading. Talk to us about the process that you went through for post.
Sure. I went out to St. Louis like 2 days after we wrapped. And my editor and I, Lucas Harger, sat for, I think it was 5 days, and got pretty close to the locked cut of the film. And then once I left, then it was, the rest was through Frame.io of us passing a few things back and forth, of tweaking minor things, but we didn't tweak a ton after that. There were just a few things. Like, we really did have pretty close to the locked cut when I left St. Louis in just 5 days, which of course is made possible because this whole film was constructed to be very little coverage.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of cutting. What the film was ultimately going to be as far as its pacing and the edit was built right into the way that I shot it. There was really only one scene, which is, you know, where she's mounting the door, that had any room for cutting around, which is also the only scene that I didn't board and a scene that I was most worried about, and probably the only scene that, you know, I'm not 100% on still, because we were in that little cubby sort of area. So there wasn't a lot of room to put the camera where I wanted it. There wasn't a lot of room to, you know, get lighting in there. So it was a really tough thing to shoot, and we didn't have a lot of time for it. If we did, I would have taken the door off of the hinges, and I would have shot out of there and just made it, you know, from the door's perspective to add that extra. And I think that really would have helped that scene move the way I wanted it to ultimately.
Yeah.
But that just didn't work out that way. So we just had to make it work. But overall, every other scene in the film, other than that one, it's really baked in how the piece was going to flow. So we were able to lock that in very, very quickly. And then after that, color and sound and score started all remotely, and all, again, being done through Frame.io, of people sending me stuff and me doing the notes through Frame.io, which is just, it's the best way to
great?
Do it. It's so great. Because I used to do like Google Docs, like somebody sends me a video and then I do Google Docs, and you have to go and, where's the time code? Okay, write the time code into the Google Doc and then try to explain it. And then they come back with, wait, what did you mean by this? And was it this or that? Whereas in Frame.io, it's right on the frame that I want to talk about. I can circle the exact thing I'm talking about. I can even do, you know, I'll you know, do that range of time of, here's where the issue is, start here, end here, don't do this here, move it down this many frames to here. So you can really die. I mean, nothing's better than sitting in the room. And for Ballistic, I actually went to LA and sat with my composer to finish off the score. And that was invaluable. Just being in the room, is you can really dive into the nuances of what you're trying to do. Whereas remotely, even with Frame.io, as you know, tight and granular you can get with Frame.io, it still doesn't replace, you know, being in the room. But you know, for this one, I couldn't go to LA for the score. But you know, it's totally, Daniel absolutely killed it. I adore what he did with the score, so I was very happy with that. But with color and sound, we just got it started with Frame.io, and then I went back out to St. Louis for 2 days with my DP Chase Smith, and Chase and Andy sat in the color suite, and they worked on, you know, getting the color to a good place. And I would just pop my head in every once in a while to see how it was going. They would show me what they have, and I'd be like, "Well, this is great. Okay, bye." You know,
yeah.
and then I was in with Steve, my sound designer and mixer, locking all of that in. And you know, it's taken a very, very long time to build a crew that is not only insanely talented, but also shares my sensibilities, that understands what I'm trying to do, has the same taste as I do. You know, we're all using the same references. Everybody just kind of gets it. And you know, when you have that, there's so much less work to do. I find that when I'm directing in those moments, it's more about we've all already gotten on the same. It's not like everybody's just conjuring something from nothing. We're already on the same page. We've already talked about what this should be, what this should feel like, you know, what tone this is. Everybody understands the same thing that we're making. So it becomes something where you kind of just, you know, push someone a little bit back on the tracks when it starts coming off the tracks a little bit, like, oh no, you're going a little bit too left, turn right a little. Yeah, there you go. On with what you were doing.
Yeah.
And you know, and they just deliver amazing work and often elevate it to a place that there's no way you would have been able to do, not necessarily on your own, because obviously not on your own, because I can't design sound design or mix or do color like, you know, they can. But if you're micromanaging, and you know, just you're beating into every single moment exactly how it should be, but giving them creative license to come in with ideas really brings extra layers to the thing than would have otherwise. So I like to really kind of sit back and, you know, same way I do with my actors. You know, with Stephanie in each scene, it was very much about, I want to see what you do with it first, and let's go from there. And I want to see what, because we've already had those conversations. She understands what, you know, the scene is. We've connected on that. We've talked about the themes. So she brings her voice into the moment and plays the scene how she sees it from her perspective of the moment and the character. And oftentimes that's even better than what it would have been if I would have said, do it exactly like this. But, you know, again, just like with that, just like with the color, all that, it, you know, there's moments where it's not quite working and it's your job to come in and go, you know, maybe go a little this way, maybe a little more, a little less, you know, remind them of the things you talked about, you know, help them get into the space to perform it the way the story wants it. But overall, that collaboration is so much fun and so appreciated.
You're so good with the gear and, you know, loving being into the lenses and the camera selections and all that stuff. Do you feel sometimes that you get too involved in the, you know, behind the camera stuff and feel like you should be spending more time with your talent? Do you ever get that feeling?
I used to, and it was a factor of, you know, not, I think, you know, a portion of coming from having to do everything myself to, you know, I had to learn to trust, you know, the talent that I was working with. But once it got to the point of working with like Ryan Booth and Chase Smith, especially with Chase, especially on There Comes a Knocking, because we already worked with each other on Ballistic. So there was already, you know, a huge amount of trust and understanding about how we work to where it just was not a factor. On especially on There Comes a Knocking, the crew was so unbelievable. I've been singing their praises nonstop and I'll just continue. They're incredible across the board, from the PAs all the way to my producers, just everyone was top of their game, but also just wonderfully kind. You know, and the whole camera team, you know, so great at what they do. And it's a factor of understanding that they know a whole lot more about it than I do. And, you know, it's where I come from, obviously, just having to do everything myself. So I know a lot about gear. So if there's ever a moment where something's like, you know, having trouble doing a thing, I can come up with an idea, hey, what if we do it this way? But more than not, you know, they know a whole lot more about it than I do. So it's more a factor of conveying what it is that I'm wanting to accomplish. So I don't have to be involved with those things anymore. I can just think creatively and remove myself from that. So especially on There Comes a Knocking, you know, it was really my goal to really focus on Stephanie and the performance and, you know, the performance of the camera, not speak to Chase so much in technical terms as in, you know, in emotional and creative and thematic terms of what the scene should be and feel like, and only come in with technical, very, very technical points when it's needed or when it's quicker. You know, definitely that happens as well. But, you know, stepping back and letting the people who you hired for the job, because they're so much better at it than you, do their job, I think really is pivotal.
What is a lesson that you learned with There Comes a Knocking, working with essentially, you know, one character who, you know, has to go through a whole variety of kind of emotions, but there's no one to really work off of until the end. But, you know, up till that point, you know, you basically have a character by herself that has to go through a whole bunch of emotions. Did you learn any specific lessons working with talent that way?
You know, and I talked about it on the show as well. But the one biggest lesson I learned on this, especially with something like this, where it is so emotional, and there is a lot of depth to that emotion, and there's a lot of conflicting feelings within the character throughout, and those emotions develop over the course of the piece as well, and they shift. And what ended up happening is we all stayed at the same hotel, and I went down in the morning of the first day of the shoot just to get, you know, the continental breakfast. And I brought my script. I was just going to read the script about, you know, 10 times or whatever. It was about an hour and a half before I had to leave. And as it turns out, Stephanie was down there, you know, getting some coffee and everything. And we were the only ones down there. So we ended up sitting together and just chatting. And of course, we'd already talked before. And I always connect with my actors before time and talk to them through Skype and talk about their character and, you know, get on the same page and everything. But through this hour and a half of just sitting there and again, in the same space, and connecting, you know, on an emotional level through, you know, what this story is about, what the feature is about, what the themes of, you know, both of those are and the depth of those themes and what they mean to us in our lives and in our experiences, what we've been through and, you know, just being very open and honest with each other and connecting in that way created a bond very quickly before we ever got on set. And a trust, which is extremely important, especially when it comes to something like this, that was just insanely helpful and, you know, not a level that I had done it on before. But now, for sure, if ever I'm doing something to this, you know, dramatic level again, I will absolutely, you know, figure out a way to find that time to have that connection, because that really helped us have a shorthand of, you know, when we were doing that scene three fireplace wine scene. Nobody knew what it meant, but I just said one, you know, sentence to her. Mm. And that got put her right where she needed to be. And
what was the sentence?
And it was no seatbelt, which I won't say what it means. It was between us.
Okay.
But nobody knew that. Even my brother afterwards was like, what does that mean? But it because of that time that we had together and you know, talking about those things, this one sentence that meant nothing to anyone else and was like, what the frick is Ryan talking about, meant a whole lot to her and put her right in the pocket I needed her to be emotionally. And that is the scene that's in the film. And it gave me a lot of, you know, made me a lot more comfortable with her to be able to try things and push her places. Because, you know, when you're doing that, there is a take in scene three where, you know, she's crying a lot harder. I wanted to take her to a certain place so I could bring her back to where I really wanted her to be. Mm-hmm. To kind of play with that emotion. And because I wanted to see it on her face, not through her performance. So, you know, the first take, I started her pretty, you know, below the level I wanted her at. And then the second take, we went and we talked a little bit and I said some stuff and we were playing music there that would help her get into the space. And then, you know, I took her much further than I wanted her to go emotionally. And then on the third take, you know, I roped her back. I let her, you know, calm down, you know, breathe a bit, you know, makeup came in, cleaned up. And then we went again with that one line and it just landed right in the pocket I was hoping she would. But you know, for me, it becomes a little nerve-wracking, you know, messing with, you know, an actor's emotions that way. I mean, obviously that's what they're there to do, but just as a human, you feel bad, you know, at least yeah. I do. But because we connected like that and we're so comfortable with each other, I could really just get in there. I think there's a picture of that scene of where we're just really close and I'm just whispering to her. And because that time together, I felt very comfortable to be able to do those things. I just think that is so important. And that's definitely the thing that that was the biggest takeaway for me.
Well, I'm glad we had you on before the Ryan Conley actor abuse scandal comes to the surface.
Oh, God.
No, the film is awesome. There Comes a Knocking. Of course, you guys are huge Ryan Conley and Film Riot fans already. And you guys, of course, know where to go, filmriot.com. But any other plugs you want to throw in here, Ryan, before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, check out the film and go to the notes of the film. We have all the partners that help make that happen. But most importantly, I have a link to our IMDb page, which has, of course, the credits of everyone who made this film a reality. Of course, you know, as writer director, you come up with this thing, and it's really that team that made, you know, the thing you're ultimately looking at. So it's, I just really appreciate and love all of them for bringing, you know, their insane talent to the thing to help realize something that was just in my head. And now all of a sudden the thing that was in my head exists, and it's really thanks to all them. So if you could check out the IMDb and take a look at all the amazing people that really made the film happen, that'd be incredible.
Well, congratulations on all your success in 10 years of Film Riot. We love having you here, and you have to come back for your next big film release. When this becomes a feature, that's when you're coming back, because you know that's going to happen.
Deal. That is a deal.
There he goes, Ryan Conley. Thank you so much for being on, and thank you guys for listening. Now, I am so inspired by Film Riot. I want so bad. I want our Instagram page to be as engaging as Film Riot's. We'll get there. We're going to get there. And while we're talking about Instagram, you guys should follow us there as well, because on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, we always post when we have upcoming guests, and we give you an opportunity to have your question asked. I also want you to follow Matt Russell over at gainstructure.com. He mixes, masters, and makes the show sound so good. He can also do this for your projects. So you can find him at gainstructure.com and on Twitter at gainstructure. And of course, our fantastic, fabulous producer, Connor Crosby. You can find him on Twitter, of course, and at ignitionvisuals.com, his production company there. But this show would not exist without the support of our fantastic sponsors. So please support them. Rule Boston Camera, Magnanimous Rentals, Hedge, Premium Beat, and Shutterstock. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those that support us. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.